Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Stompcast with me, Dr. Alex George. This is the podcast where I go for a walk with a guest to take a little wander into their life. This week I'm stomping with therapy with Abby, aka Abby Rawlinson. Abby is an integrative therapist, which is quite a hard word to say, and the author of Reclaiming You, your therapy toolkit for life's twists and turns. Really is bringing the theory from therapy into your hands in a way you can apply in your own life. It's perfect. After working in the media industry for over 15 years, Abby retrained to become a therapist and has built a strong following of over 150,000 people on Instagram with her powerful and helpful infographics which cover why you shouldn't feel guilty about resting, how to protect yourself from burnout, and how to cope with being triggered. Her new book is described as an empowering, practical guide to the tools of therapy you need to know. And I'm looking forward to finding out some of these tools in this episode. We're going to be covering how to identify your triggers and what are glimmers in part one. In part two, we'll look at how to stop being a people pleaser, which I think a lot of us can relate to. And in part three, what is reparenting and how do you start? Abby, welcome to the Stompcast. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
This could be a confusing Stompcast because you're an Abby and we've also got Abby here taking the photographs and the videos and things.
And so, we both get called Abs.
And you both get called Abs as well. Is that what's the most common way people talk to you? Apart from therapy, obviously, with with Abby online.
Abs, Abby. I'm actually an Abigail, but I don't like her.
Also, so is Abigail.
Oh, really?
Abs is also an Abigail. Oh my gosh, we've just been hit by the biggest gust of wind. We've been recording this Stompcast quite a bit over the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And every single day we've recorded, it's tried to rain quite a lot. But I've gone, do you know what? It's fine. We'll enjoy it. Although I did make a bit of a mistake because the last one, I made the rookie error of thinking, it's a park. It'll be fine. I'll just wear my trainers.
And like me.
To be fair, Abby said, put your boots on. It's going to be muddy. I thought, I'll be all right. So I obviously didn't listen. And ended up with really muddy trainers and ended up having to put them through the wash. But they did survive, actually.
What?
But now we've got the opposite problem. I'm wearing boots. But we're okay. Look, the path's okay.
Yeah, I did choose a path. I mean, we obviously have to deal with the elements, but I do love that we're outdoors doing this.
Oh, and I must actually... Abby, should I start my Strava? I should, shouldn't I? I'll just take a moment to put the Strava on. Because if anyone wants to follow me on Strava, I am on there. I do my running, I'm a stomping. So I'm going to put a record on here, right? So I've got to change it onto walking. And then start. There we go. So if anyone wants to follow me on Strava, give me a follow. I have to remind me Abs to turn off at the end. That's all right. So the good news is we've got the Strava on the go and we've sorted the mics out. we're good to go. So whereabouts are we then? Where have you chosen to bring us stomping today?
So we are in Walthamstow Marshes.
And of course, we have been back here with Lauren Mahon. We're not back here. We were here before Lauren. And we had a good old stomp. That was actually... a nighttime one, so we're here in the day. And actually, I must say, do you know what?
You can actually see.
The sun's coming through the clouds.
I know. I've been watching the weather all morning, and it had suddenly just got bright. I think we've been quite lucky.
Well, we're going to enjoy it. I'm very grateful for you for joining us. Were you in clinic this morning? What was your morning?
Well, actually, I'm not. I'm still on maternity leave from clients at the moment. So I was promoting the book while I was kind of on mat leave.
Congratulations, of course.
Thank you.
On both.
Thank you.
It was primarily the birth of a child.
Thank you. But actually, it was kind of wild because the day that I found out I was pregnant was the same day I got the book deal.
Wow.
So it was like...
That's a lot of emotions.
Yeah, it
was. Lots of oxytocin and serotonin and endorphins all in one.
But also, like, panic.
Goodness me. So how have you... Have you managed that? Because that is a lot. I mean, we talk about, you obviously talk about it with your clients, I'm sure, you know, this idea that when bad things happen, we go, bad things have happened. That makes sense that I feel stressed and overwhelmed. But actually, good things give us a sense of overwhelm as well. But often we don't expect it. We think, got a promotion or, you know, move to a new city, we think, oh, that's really great. But actually that can put a lot of weight on us, can't it? And that can put a lot of pressure
on
us.
Yeah, I think it's really helpful to kind of remember that we can experience like more than one feeling at the same time, even if it's contradictory feelings. So, you know, I can feel like this joy and gratitude about having a baby and being able to write a book, but it's also okay to feel nervous and scared. I don't have to choose one or the other. And I think sometimes people can be quite black and white about feelings and feel like it has to be good or bad. But actually, when we accept that we can feel multiple things at the same time, then we take the pressure off ourselves to try and fix our feelings, you know, and instead we just lean into them.
Very true. I like that point, the thing you can feel lots of things at the same time. It's like getting a new job. You might be really excited about that, but also really nervous because you're going to have a new environment and you don't know, maybe you're having to step up into a more senior role, but you're feeling all those things at the same time. And I think it's kind of becomes confusing. And sometimes it gets distressing when you think, oh, I should be really just purely excited about this, but I also feel a bit of dread. You know, I thought this when I had, basically I had this award from this university a little while ago. And I was like, this is amazing. But I also had to go and do quite a big speech. And I was really nervous about doing the speech. Or at least I felt it was out. I wouldn't say nervous is quite the right word, but it was very much outside of. You put yourself in a position of discomfort, I guess.
Yes.
It's a good thing.
Yes.
But I felt quite mixed emotions about the whole thing, and I felt almost guilty about that, actually, in a way.
Yeah, and it's hard, isn't it? Because I think sometimes when we have those mixed feelings, or we have difficult feelings, especially when it comes to making decisions, like you say, like starting a new job, we might just listen to the nerves and think, "Oh, am I doing the right thing?" Like, you know. Sometimes we think we have to wait until we're 100% happy with something before we say yes to it.
Mm.
But actually, we'll probably never make any changes if that's the case. Like, we kind of have to accept that change comes with multiple feelings.
And an element of risk often as well. I mean, I was talking about this on the Dr. Alex Diaries session. So I do these diaries that I release every Thursday for those that are subscribing to on Apple Podcasts.
Mm.
And I was talking about this idea that sometimes, like, over planning and trying to really over prepare for everything prevents us taking a leap. Like, there's a lot of leap of faith in situations, almost like, you know, you start a business, you can't plan to the 100% the whole business because the world changes, something happens, a pandemic happens, and all of a sudden your business, there's always things that are changing. You've got to plan like 70-80%, then you kind of have to jump, don't you? You have to take the leap, and that's similar a lot in life. And I wonder, some of the feelings we feel when we've got these mixed emotions, they're trying to hold us back, and you can easily go, actually, maybe I won't take this on, or actually, I don't want to do this. But you're not actually moving towards where you want to be. You're moving away from a position of fear, isn't it?
It's like, you almost have to like take that leap, and then your confidence will kind of catch up, because you're never going to feel 100% confident and ready to do something.
Mm. You talk about imposter syndrome quite a bit in your book. And I wonder how much the kind of, what do you think about like fake it till you make it kind of idea, this idea of you kind of sometimes you've got to just fake the confidence. Do you believe in that?
I think there is some truth in that. Like, I do think that sometimes you do have to step out of your comfort zone in order to move forward, otherwise you'll just kind of stay still. But I also think if we're going to fake it, then we're kind of stepping away from our authenticity.
Mm.
And actually, if we do too much outside of our comfort zone, we're going to freak ourselves out and retreat. And so it's kind of like, I think you have to find the right degree of challenge.
Because there's a balance, isn't there? Like, imposter syndrome, to an extreme extent, is actually a way of, it's not actually necessarily a syndrome. It's like you feel like an imposter in a situation where you really are not, you don't have the right skill sets, then it's not that you're imposter, is a very harsh word, but you probably need to think about what you're doing. For example, like, if I graduated from med school, was a first day doctor, and started trying to do heart surgery, I don't feel imposter syndrome because I need to have like a pat on the back and say, go for it, I shouldn't be performing the heart surgery.
Yes.
But for most people, that isn't what's happening, is it? They actually are doing things that are either on the edge of their comfort zone or within it, but most often obviously on the edge of it, because that's where they feel discomfort. And if we listen to those messages, we don't go for things, do we? And then we convince ourselves quite easily that we don't deserve to do that, or we're not good enough, or someone else should do it instead.
Yeah, and you know, the people that seem to have imposter syndrome are often really successful people who are really qualified. You know, I've never heard someone describe imposter syndrome and be thinking, oh God, yeah, you are an imposter. You know, it's people feeling like a fraud when they're actually completely capable.
And is that what you see with clients and things, and people you speak to and you've spoken to over the years?
Yeah, I see it a lot. And it can be, you know, it can lead to a lot of anxiety and stress, and it can make people overwork and overprepare and kind of burn themselves out. But it can also, on the other end of the spectrum, lead to this kind of like life paralysis where people are just like stuck and they are afraid to move forward because they kind of fear failure at every turn. But what I often say to people is, it's actually natural to feel a bit anxious when you're stepping out of your comfort zone. Like, that doesn't mean that you're an imposter. It just means that you're doing something out of your comfort zone. And sometimes when people can get their head around that, it can bring quite a lot of comfort, because you're not trying to eliminate the anxiety. You're kind of just having to accept that that's part of the process.
I don't know if this really is a very good example or not, but I'm going to say it because it popped into my head. I was talking to my friend last night, and we were talking about, like, when you move house and you go somewhere new, it's so odd that when you move into the new place or new flat or whatever it is, even though you're really excited about getting it, when you move in, well, certainly I do, for the first good 3 or 4 weeks, I feel really uncomfortable being there. It feels alien. I almost sometimes feel a sense of being homesick. But then give it like a few months and all of a sudden it's your place of comfort and home. But if you were like listening to that feeling at that time, you might have been like, that's it, I'm getting out of here. You know, like panic home kind of thing. Or you're staying at your mate's house when you're younger and you get homesick. You're like on the phone, get me home, mum.
You kind of have buyer's remorse and you think, what have I done?
It's because sometimes our feelings, or like what we're feeling at that time, it's not guiding us very well. Sometimes what we're feeling isn't the right answer.
Yeah, sometimes our feelings aren't the most reliable compass.
So how can that kind of imposter syndrome, how can someone really identify it and go, okay, I'm feeling this, but that doesn't mean that I need to respond by running away from it or pulling out of that job or whatever. How can someone convince themselves that actually what they're feeling is just normal?
Well, I think a lot of it is just down to like self-validation and validating your feelings. You know, I think so many of us are convinced that we need to be feeling happy 100% of the time. And that if we're not feeling happy, then we're not doing something right. But actually, you know, we've got this whole kaleidoscope of emotions that we need to feel. And if we can validate and say, you know, it's okay that I'm feeling anxious right now, or it's understandable that I'd be feeling sad about this, then we stop trying to fix our feelings. Mm. That makes sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. And I think on the point of comfort and happiness, I think if you're trying to be like a peace or a comfort, like in happiness all the time, is a sure way of never being in happiness, is it? Because it's just impossible. Like, I think it's I was thinking this the other day, is, you know, we often expect to get up each day in the morning feeling 100% and great every single day.
Yeah.
But that's what a machine or a robot might do.
Yes.
Some days you get up and you just don't feel 100%. You feel 50%, 60%.
Yeah.
And I feel like what I've been learning, certainly the last year or so, is that that's not a problem, but it's a problem if you start berating yourself or you start getting distressed because you're not at 100%. You're aware, because you feel in your stomach, oh, I'm at 60% today. And that's okay. If you then have a very compassionate day and you go, that's okay, well, I'll do today as a 60% and I'm cool with it, then you recuperate. But what I've found is that when I've, particularly because I'm quite a type A person, when I've responded by being annoyed at myself or distressed because of I feel that way, that actually compounds it.
Oh,
and it's
massively.
That makes you unhappy, not the fact that you're just at 60%.
Yeah, because actually when we have like a really harsh inner critic, we actually like can trigger our own stress response. You know, like if we are berating ourselves for feeling a certain way, then like activating our stress response, and we can put ourselves into like fight or flight mode and feel even more stressed. And actually you use the word compassion, and that's a much better route to go when we're feeling not 100%, is to just practice a bit of self-kindness and speak to ourselves the way we would a good friend.
I mean, if I allow myself, I can quite easily trigger a lot of anxiety from feeling at 60%.
Yeah.
So because, you know, I've kind of grown up quite a bit with this idea, I don't know quite where it comes from, I thought about it a little bit, but this idea that I don't want to waste time. And not necessarily like the superly it is a bit of overproductivity, but also just in the sense of like, I just have this feeling that time is so precious, which it is. But if you take it too far, then actually you're ironically wasting your time worrying about time.
Yeah.
But I find then if I'm at 60% and I wake up that way, that actually triggers me to feel anxious if I allow it. If I don't go, right, okay, that's fine. Today's gonna be a good day. Like 60% is fine. We'll roll with it. If I do that, I'm okay. But if I go with that mindset of like, why am I not feeling good? Come on, bam, that makes me feel on edge then.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes we're looking for answers. You know, why do I feel this way? And sometimes actually what we need to do is just accept it and like be kind to ourselves and realize that tomorrow's another day.
It's an odd thing with a you know, specifically coming from a therapy hat, I guess, like people often think you know, we always need to be digging for answers for stuff and coming out with like, why do I, what's the specific thing that's happened that makes me feel like this way? But sometimes you just got to accept that you're just not having a great day. Like,
yeah,
we don't have to dig out every answer, do we?
Yeah, and I think sometimes we think that there's these, like, we need to have these really like complex analytical tools, but sometimes it's just, if you wake up feeling not so great, sometimes it's really simple questions like, what have I been eating recently? Like, have I had enough sleep? You know, have I journaled about my feelings? Or, you know, just checking in with yourself instead of trying to like decipher this specific thing that might
this
have caused
code. Yeah, because actually deciphering that and getting frustrated actually ironically makes you feel more depleted, doesn't it?
Yeah,
or can do.
Yeah, exactly. It's exhausting.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'd like to talk to you about this idea of identifying triggers and also your concept of glimmers. I was wondering if you could kind of talk us through that. Like, why do you think there is a benefit of identifying the triggers? And yeah, what are glimmers as we walk under, hello, as we walk under an arch? Or a bridge.
Yeah, so triggers are the people or places or situations that create a sense of fear and can like activate our threat defences. And so we might go into like a stressed out fight or flight mode if we hear a burglar alarm go off in the night or if a car swerves towards us, right? But sometimes we can go into survival mode when nothing like scary or stressful is actually happening, and it can be really confusing. And so, you know, for example, say if your partner comes back from the shops and they've bought the wrong kind of bread, and suddenly you feel overwhelmed with anger and you're like, why am I so angry about this? This is just bread. Like, why am I going into fight or flight mode right now? It can be really, really confusing. But often when we're having like an overly dramatic reaction to something, it's to do with an emotional trigger, which is where we are unconsciously reminded of something painful from our past or a past trauma, like typically from our childhood. So if we were to kind of dig into the bread example, we might discover that your reaction is actually not really about the bread. It might be about having this a pattern of being denied things you enjoy in your childhood, or perhaps there's some unprocessed frustration about not being listened to by a parent. And so when we're triggered in this way, it's like the reopening of a old wound that hasn't had a chance to heal. It's kind of past pain in the present moment.
And so anything that does that is the trigger. And as you're talking, it's funny, I was thinking one trigger that I have that the team knows about is that if someone says to me, I've got bad news or got a bit of bad news, I know that sounds like obvious, like that people say, well, yeah, that's obviously going to make you feel quite triggered, but I find it extremely triggering, because bad news to me was being called and told that my brother's died. And that was like kind of the call. Like, I've got bad news and this has happened. And like, it really, really triggers my fight or flight. Like, my stomach always drops. And most of the time people are saying, like, I've got bad news, dinner's cancelled later. But my brain and my emotions and my physiology goes to, you're about to tell me that someone has died. That's how I feel.
Of course, and so, that's so understandable.
And so the guys now know, I say, please, if something happens, just tell me the information, and then I'll decide what level it is. Do you know what I mean? So it's like,
yes.
Okay, something has, and something might be medium or not very bad or quite bad, but let me process it. Don't preface it with that. Because it really triggers me. Maybe I should work on that specifically. But
well, you are working on it because you've identified what the trigger is, yeah. And you're communicating to people about how you want them to communicate with you, and that's like setting a boundary.
And the girls
it?
Are great at it, actually, I must say as well.
Oh,
they
good.
Do. They're really, really good. They know that. Just try and avoid that because it's just like a startle response. Almost.
Oh, that must be horrible.
Mm. Yeah, when your brain goes to a certain place. It's not even just your brain; it's your body.
And
it's instant.
Yes,
it's like
it's really
just
physical.
To say it, it's like a physical feeling in your gut, like, oh my God. And it takes you back to that moment. And I guess, you know, I've had PTSD because of everything that's happened, and I'm very much recovered mostly, I'd say 80-90% from that. But obviously there's still remnants, aren't there? Or always remnants of these things that are still gonna come back up, right?
Yeah, of course. And you know, sometimes when we can identify a trigger, it can be really helpful because it can remind us that, you know, there's some more grieving to do or some wounds to heal. But, you know, sometimes it's even really hard to, like, identify the trigger. It can take a bit of work. And, you know, often that's what people do in therapy. But obviously that's not accessible to everyone. There are ways you can kind of try and figure it out on your
like
own.
Like your book, for example, you talk about identifying these triggers. So, like, so for someone that's thinking, do you know what I do? Gosh, we're walking across a cattle grid. We've actually been dodging puddles, walking across cattle grids.
It's like an obstacle course.
Yeah, we love it, though. We love it. It's all stomping. So for people, talk a little bit more about that process of identifying. Perhaps if it's not as obvious. Like, for me, that's an obvious trigger for me. I'm very easy to identify. It's an obvious. It makes sense to me as well. What kind of process can you go through to start honing it in? Because some people might not be aware at all that their emotional reactions are because of something that's triggered it.
Just totally.
Complete unawareness.
Yeah, I mean, there's a phrase that we often use, which is, if it's hysterical, it's historical, which is quite useful.
Wow, that is actually really good.
It's good, isn't it?
I really like that.
So this kind of sense of, like, if you're having like a reaction to something that's disproportionate to the situation, then the chances are it's something to do with your past.
Wow.
And so if you think you've had a hysterical moment, kind of look back on that moment and try and work out, like, when did you go from feeling okay to not okay?
Yeah.
You know, was it a comment from your boss? Was it a message from your friend? And then try and identify how you felt emotionally and in your body. You know, did you feel angry? Did you feel like immense sadness, like extreme jealousy? And then try and figure out if that's reminiscent of an old feeling, you know, like kind of ask yourself, like, is there an event in my childhood that triggered a similar response? Like, is this a familiar feeling? What does it remind me of? And once we can start to identify our triggers, we can kind of, it's so empowering really, because it can move us from this feeling of like, oh, well, that's just who I am, to saying things like, well, that's how I respond, which sounds like a subtle difference. But actually, when we know how we respond to things, we can do like what you did, which we can communicate to others and try and set boundaries. Or we can just be more compassionate towards ourselves when we have like a big reaction.
Well, how I am feels very unchangeable.
Yes.
How I respond feels like, well, there's some element of choice that's been made in responding. It's
absolutely.
Quite actually, you're right. It sounds quite simple, but actually in reality, it's quite a big difference. It's like, oh, unfortunately, this is never going to change, versus like, oh, actually, maybe there are things I can do to work on this.
Exactly. And that's when these glimmers come in, because
I love the glimmers. The glimmers of hope.
Glimmers of hope. I just love it. It's a concept that comes from a therapist and nervous system specialist called Deb Dana. And glimmers are basically the opposite of triggers. So glimmers are people or places or resources that help us feel safe and settled. They soothe our nervous system. And so glimmers can be things that you do on your own, which we call self-regulating glimmers, or things that you do with others, which are co-regulating glimmers. And it's really simple stuff. You know, like, glimmers you do on your own could be going for a walk in nature, doing some exercise, watching a comforting TV show, doing some painting, anything that makes you feel safe and calm. And things that you can do with other people, it might be speaking to a therapist, or having a deep and meaningful with a friend, or having a hug, or even like a cuddle with your pet, like anything that soothes you. And so glimmers are a great way to soothe yourself if you've felt triggered about something, you know. But we can also just like integrate them into our daily life for, you know, if we are feeling stressed or overwhelmed or low. I often invite people to create what I call a glimmers game plan. Because when we're stressed or triggered, like, we can totally forget all the positive actions that we can take to feel better.
All the positive things as well.
Yeah.
You immediately go to a certain place where you become like instantly fight or flight, negative.
Yeah.
Kind of pretty pessimistic.
Yes. And like nothing's going to help.
No.
You know?
Defeatist in a way.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, I have a list of my glimmers like as a note pinned on my phone.
That's a great idea. So if you're listening, maybe that's a good one to do. But yeah, maybe write some of your glimmers down now as we're talking and just have them pinned. I think that's a great, you know, trick to have. I mean, I've got a few things in my notes that I go and read. I ironically have my tattoos like "This Too Shall Pass" on my arms to help with certain things. So having those kind of things to hand does make a difference, doesn't it? Like when we talk about the emergency toolkit for your mental health, have that made in preparation for, not doing that and, you know, trying to create, okay, what am I going to do to help myself when I'm really struggling? You know, prepare that in the good times so that you're ready for difficult times.
Yeah,
and I guess that's
the,
when you're triggered because you're feeling heightened, you're on edge, you may be very upset, it's harder to think straight.
Oh,
so having it in your hand on your notes means like, bam, right, what am I going to do? Okay, this is the plan.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously, you know, if you're massively triggered and you're feeling rage, you're not going to be like, oh, I'm just going to get my watercolors out.
Yeah.
You know, there's certain things for certain situations.
Go for a run, maybe. That would be one I'd do.
Yeah. And the next level of having the pinned note on your phone can be to work out which glimmers work best in different situations. And that's really personal. But often, if we're feeling more in the kind of fight or flight, angry, anxious, we need things to like discharge our energy.
Yeah.
So that'll be like going for a run or like organizing our home or doing some high intensity exercise. But those things feel like impossible when you're feeling at the other end of the spectrum, which is feeling like flat and low.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
There's no way I'm gonna go for a run.
So you're triggered,
like
you can be triggered to a heightened state, but you can be triggered into a very flat state as
well. Yes, exactly. And so when you're in that flat state, you need things to gently mobilize your energy rather than discharge energy. So that might be having a hot shower or sitting in a place where there's a lot of busy activity. Mm. Anything that's kind of gently re-energize you, because we all know when we feel like that level of flat, we're not going to go for a run. It feels impossible.
Yeah.
And then a lot of shame can come into that. But once we can do these small little glimmers that can lift our energy a bit, we can then end up on a bit of an upward spiral and get to a more regulated place.
So someone's listening, perhaps what they could do then is put glimmers in their notes and then go glimmers for a heightened state, glimmers for a flat state, or glimmers when I feel flat. And then perhaps then you've got, because there's two different distinctions then, haven't you? You could look at those and see, what do I feel like doing? And I guess it does change as well, doesn't it? One day you might be like, oh, no, I'll go and do a run, or another day it might be like, I'll pick one of the other things on the list.
Yeah, I mean, I've got my list split, but I also update it and change it. Like, it looked different when I was pregnant. It looks different now that I have a child. You know, it's a sort of ever-evolving thing, and it's there's also a bit of trial and error involved in it. But it can be quite fun. Like, I've had clients make, like, Pinterest boards and mood boards and scrapbooks of all their glimmers, and even that in itself is quite a soothing activity.
Is there an element of benefit as well in terms of, if you're triggered by something, and you know this is a trigger, and then you move towards a glimmer, is that also beneficial for the brain in terms of getting over those initial triggers? Because we know that obviously exposure to a trigger eventually over time, say it's a photograph, for example, that triggers something, each time you look at that, as painful as it is, it tends not to reach the same height as before, does it?
Exactly. I mean,
obviously that's not a linear process, but over time you get used to things, don't you?
Yeah,
you see a photo,
well, the
or whatever.
Effects of glimmers can be cumulative. So you can actually heal some of your triggers by using these glimmers. So if you are triggered by something and then you consistently soothe yourself after that, you're effectively like showing your nervous system that it's safe and that the past is the past, and in the present you're safe.
Because the thing about triggers, if I'm right, is that say you see a photograph that brings back really painful memories, your brain is reacting to what it perceives to be a threat or a danger with a physiological and emotional response that it believes is appropriate for that threat. But of course, you're looking at something that isn't a threat anymore, but the brain thinks it's been taught that that is the reaction it needs when it sees something or experiences something. So I guess by, you know, applying to the glimmers and rather than following that spiral of like, right, I'm heightened, I feel awful, I'm upset, now I need to, like, you know, that fight or flight thing, or, oh yeah, I'm absolutely flat, this is awful. Mm. You're actually trying to retrain the brain that that photo doesn't have to equate to feeling awful. But yeah, actually that photo doesn't need to equate to anything.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how we build a more resilient system. And, you know, we're not trying to feel calm and relaxed all the time. Like, we can't escape the fact that there will be certain things that trigger us. But actually what we want to try and get to is a place where we can recover quickly from feeling triggered, you know, instead of getting stuck in that mode all day or, you know, for weeks on end sometimes.
It is interesting how different triggers do send you in different directions. Because, so for example, when, so like my brother's birthday was the other week, so I'm 15th of February, he's 19th of February, so my birthday is always, it's always difficult for those reasons. And but I find that it often does make me, I feel heightened a bit running up to it, then I feel flat for a good 5 or 6 days afterwards, which is odd, because actually, to be honest, I have always been a bit like, look, it's just a day, it's not better or worse any other day of the week or year that he's not here. And I've kind of tried cognitively to think my way through that, but it's odd how that actually doesn't translate to my emotional reaction to it. I do actually do just feel flat for 5 or 6 days. Like now, the last couple of days, I've picked up out of it again. It's odd, I can almost feel my mood lifting. And I can't, I almost like, I cut to a point and then I'm like lifting out of it and I feel good again. It's such an odd thing though. It's like, but then other things will give me the really triggered reaction where I'm like heightened. And it's almost quite predictable in a way. But it's just odd how those are two polar opposite reactions to something.
Well, I think with your brother, you know, it's grief, isn't it? So, you know, grief often comes in waves and we kind of don't have much control over it. And sometimes we just have to like surrender to it and let it wash over us. And it's painful as hell. But
I'm trying to, that's something I've been working on, is trying to get better at that, of just letting that be. Like, I'm a fixer. It's why I was a doctor. It's why I do all the work things I do now. It's why that's who I am, right? I'm just a fixer. Actually, my friend always says I'm a fixer and a coper. There's two things I am, right? And those things, if you put them together, it's like pushing through stuff. And I think with the grief things, you actually do, you do just have to surrender to it. Almost like the same, the time stuff. I get frustrated, and if I'm at 60%, I have to be careful to prevent that spiral. Same with grief. I'm like, no, come on, like, you've got to, Claire would want you to push on, like, get on with it, but actually you gotta go, hang on, steady on, you do actually just need to feel the stuff here, you know?
Yeah, there's a bit of perfectionism maybe going on there as well, of like, you know, we can be a perfectionist about how we feel. And the surrendering's really hard, but actually, you know, feelings are a bit like tunnels, you know, we have to go through them to get to the light at the end, and avoiding them just prolongs the pain, you know.
Avoid the avoidance.
We try and avoid, we try and numb, we try and do anything to sort of escape painful feelings, but actually we do just have to lean into them to like come out the other end.
And often if you try and you are successful in, to some degree, avoiding it in the daytime, it can affect your sleep, doesn't it? Because a lot of people, you must have a lot of people come to you saying, I don't sleep. And often our brain, because that's the bit when the brain, it was actually phenomenal. I had a bit of a tangent. I was doing a talk at school a week or so back. And this, I think he couldn't have been more than 7 or 8 years old. Maybe no, come on, a bit older. Maybe he was 9, but no older. I was saying to him, like, what happens to sleep? And he said, oh, well, in sleep, it's the time when the brain sorts out the files and the filing cabinets and puts it in the right order so that then the next day you're ready to deal with new files.
Oh, that's so clever.
And I was just like, oh, my God. I was like, that's amazing. I was literally, like, really moved. I was like, oh, my God, this young boy. Like, it's just phenomenal, you know, just unbelievable. But it's that point, isn't it? If you try and trying to avoid it too much, then in your brain, in your sleep, that's when a lot of it will come out and it'll start affecting you at that time instead. So
You know, we distract ourselves all day, we can get into like hyperactivity and chronic busyness, and and then we lay our head down at night and we're like, oh, why can't I sleep?
And then you have to face it then. So basically avoid that avoidance. So if you're going to summarize, as we come to the end of part one, this idea between the triggers and the glimmers, could you just summarize some of the stuff we've talked about then, just for the takeaways at the end of this part?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, triggers, emotional triggers are people, places or situations that create a sense of danger, and they unconsciously remind us of past pains or past traumas, typically from our childhood. And we can have an overreaction to a certain situation. Mm. And we can use this phrase, if it's hysterical, it's historical, like reminding us that...
I love that phrase.
Yeah, it's good. And then, if we're having a reaction that's disproportionate to the situation, then maybe we need to explore some things from our past. Like, what is this situation reminding me of? Is it a familiar feeling from my childhood? And then we can use this wonderful concept of glimmers, which are... people, places and resources that help our nervous system feel calm and regulated. And that might be anything from walking in nature or doing breathing exercises or having a hug, anything that makes our nervous system feel relaxed. And it's useful to kind of have the list of all those things in one place that you can easily access, because when we're dysregulated and triggered, we can totally forget what we need to do to soothe ourselves.
And perhaps one thing a little thought as we end this part as well, is that being careful not to go to things you think are glimmers but aren't glimmers. Go into a big one, I think personally is social media. Sometimes when you're feeling bad, you think social media can give you comfort, but often it makes you feel worse. And it might not, and it might actually be something you find. Some people really do find a lot of comfort, and it does depend what it is. Some things I find really comfort from there, but just be a bit careful, because sometimes you think things are glimmer. I'm just using that as an example. And you go to it, and actually it's not a glimmer, it's an avoidant.
Exactly. Well, there's a chapter in my book called Numbing, which touches on this, of the things that we kind of reach for to try and dull down our emotions, and that might be drinking or social media or online shopping or, any of these kind of compulsive behaviours. But sometimes...
Food, that used to be a really big one for me, I must say, food.
And food is one that we can often get, mix it up with a glimmer. Because you might think... Oh, I'm just going to sit in front of the TV and eat some chocolate cake. That's really comforting and soothing and self-loving. And it can be, right? That could be a glimmer. But it could also be a numbing tactic.
It's the same tool can be both, isn't it? That's
exactly
the thing. A tool can have many. So if one person running could be a really helpful tool, but if you're using running to bash yourself and overact and beat yourself up, punish yourself by running, that's not a glimmer.
It's not,
but equally,
exactly.
It also can be an amazing thing, that running could be your, like it is for me, that just kind of oxygen almost to the brain.
Can change day to day for each person. And I think the way to decipher, is this a glimmer or am I numbing, is to just try and explore your intention. Mm. It's like, am I trying to be kind to myself here, or am I trying to avoid a difficult feeling?
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much. We'll come to the end of part one. In part two, we're going to talk about people pleasing and how to not be a people pleaser. I think this is something that I would imagine most people can relate to, right? So
yes. We'll
be coming on to that in part two very soon. Thank you, everyone. Hope you've had a great stomp, whether you're joining us now immediately for part two, or whether you're coming back another day. Well, we'll see you soon. We look forward to it. Take care. Goodbye.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea, with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.